This is episode one of The Sweetest One, a Paul Kingston mystery, written and read by Stephen L. Moss. Chapter 1. Billy Reno called me the night he died. By the next morning, I was the prime suspect in his murder. How many times since then have I wished I'd missed that call? More than I can count. It had been 2 years since I'd heard from him, and it sounded like the same old drunken plea.
Paul, help me!
Billy?
Help me, Paul! Christ!
I heard him sobbing, or maybe he had the dry heaves. He talked like he had a mouthful of cotton balls. You're wasted as usual, I said. Go find some place to sleep it off.
No! Lou! Bish! Bah! Ah! Shit!
I don't even know what the hell you're saying.
Chasing me! Jesus! Paul!
Whatever, Billy. Go vomit on somebody else. I hung up. I had every right to. Billy Reno did all he could to fuck up my life last time I gave him the chance. But even so, I began to feel like an asshole for blowing him off. So by the time the text message came from the same number 15 minutes later, I had started to change my mind about things. Please, Paul, the message said. Meet me at Enrique's. Please. My memory's a little shaky on what happened next. I went to Enrique's, one of those Mexican places run by white folks, with the walls painted all Pottery Barn green and gray, and neon beer signs the only decorations. But Billy didn't show. I couldn't tell you how many drinks I had. I couldn't tell you much at all. I don't remember telling my sob story to anyone who would listen, about how I'd been in Billy's band, that we'd been going places, really going places, until Billy's paranoid schizophrenia, or whatever he had, combined with his tendency to self-medicate, had caused him to lose the last of his marbles, wander off, and literally leave me and the rest of the band standing on a stage in front of 10,000 fans right in the middle of our first big tour. About how the aftermath of that disaster had cost me my marriage and all of my professional credibility. About how after finally gaining a toehold in the Nashville music scene, I was now a washed-up has-been who'd slunk back to his hometown, Milwaukee fucking Wisconsin, to scrounge gigs and wait for his turn on an episode of Where Are They Now? Later, I heard I'd said all those things and more. Depending on who you asked, I even had a thing or two to say about what I might do if I ever got my hands on that no-show son of a bitch. Needless to say, none of this looked so good on my record the next day when the cops started coming around. The ringing phone nearly split my head in two. I opened eyes that were trying to stick shut and nearly got blinded by mid-morning April sunshine. For a moment, I had no idea where I was. Then I realized I was in my living room, sleeping on the couch. I had a hangover that seemed to start way down in the base of my spine and extend into somewhere in the next county.
"Hello?" I said.
"Paul, is that you?"
Through the haze of sleep and a splitting pain in my head, I recognized my ex-wife's voice.
"Susan?" I said. "What's going on? What time is it?"
"It's almost noon. Where were you last night?" I tried to remember, but in that instant, I didn't have the foggiest idea where I'd been.
"I don't know. Why the fuck would you care? It's not like we're married anymore."
I heard her catch herself on the other end, as if she was about to snap at me, but got it under control.
"Let me start over." She lowered her voice. "Paul, do you know that Billy Reno was murdered last night?"
In the daze that still fogged my mind from sleep, I thought for a moment I must be dreaming. I had just talked to Billy. He had asked me to meet him. Now I was dreaming he was dead.
"What?"
was all I managed to say. "Listen to me, Paul. Billy was murdered, beat to death. Did you see him last night?
No. Christ, Susan, are you shitting me?
No. You didn't see him?
He called me, asked to meet. I agreed, but he never showed up.
There was noise on her end of the line.
I've got to go, Paul. There's going to be a detective coming by to question you.
Me?
Susan, you can't seriously think I would...
I don't want to think it, Paul, she said. But you went to Enrique's last night and made it known that you hated his guts. What the hell did you do that for?
I did?
Don't play games with me. I'm just trying to help you.
I'm not playing games. I don't really remember much about last night.
You think that's going to fly with the homicide detectives?
You're not on the case?
Course not. Conflict of interest.
Then how come you know so much about whatever I was doing last night?
Through the grapevine.
Was this really happening?
Billy Reno, murdered?
Christ, he had called me, told me someone was after him. I had told him to leave me alone. After all, he had always thought someone was after him. Usually it was the FBI. So this time he had finally been telling the truth?
And a detective was coming here?
Susan was a cop herself, Milwaukee PD, so she would know. I stood up and realized I was still drunk. I swayed on my feet, my legs like half-cooked spaghetti. My stomach sent a shot of acid up into my throat and I retched. How much had I had to drink last night?
More than I'd had in years, it felt like. I cursed my stupidity.
After 42 years on this planet, you'd think a guy would learn when it's time for last call.
Cops, coming here.
When? I managed to get to the bathroom, splashed water on my face, my hair, brushed my teeth, fighting back more heaves. I had slept in my clothes. They stunk of alcohol and cigarette smoke, but I didn't know if there was time to change. In that still drunk but already hungover state, the idea of making coffee seemed way too much to wrap my brain around, so I went for a packet of Starbucks Instant. I had just managed to boil the water and stir the powder into a cup when the doorbell rang. I live on the second floor of a duplex. I held tight to the railing as I made my way down the stairs, fighting to control my sodden muscles, feeling like some kid who's gotten drunk for the first time and has to try and get past Mom and Dad. A crazy urge to giggle caught hold of me at that thought. I paused, looked at the man-shaped shadow waiting outside the door, and the urge went away. When I opened the door, the blonde man with the military-style haircut standing on my porch looked more like an ex-Marine who was masquerading as a banker than a cop. His suit strained at the seams, as if he would transform into the Incredible Hulk at any minute. His smile was even tighter than his suit.
"Mr. Paul Kingston?" he asked.
"Yes," I squinted against the sun. The back of my neck throbbed like it was about to give birth to something.
"Detective Roy Everhard," the man said, flashing me a wallet that displayed his badge. "Milwaukee PD Homicide Division, may I ask you a few questions?"
"What's going on?"
"Mr. Kingston, are you acquainted with a Billy Reno?"
"Yes."
"How do you know him?"
"We used to work together. He fronted a band. I was the bass player."
"And where were you last night between 9 o'clock p.m. and midnight?"
"Over at Enrique's on Delaware Street."
"You were there the whole time?"
"I think so. To tell you the truth, I got pretty drunk and I don't remember much about last night."
"That right," Everhard looked at me thoughtfully, the way a hawk must look at a mouse right before ripping it to shreds.
"You sure you didn't go anywhere else?"
"Well, honestly, no. I don't remember, like I said. What's this about?"
"Mr. Kingston, Billy Reno was beaten to death last night. Now, would you happen to know anything about that?"
"Beaten to death?"
I'd already heard this, of course, but I guess it hadn't sunken in yet.
"Right. And I have witnesses who say you were in Enrique's telling the whole world how he screwed you over and how you'd like to get your hands on him."
"Did you?"
"Did I what?"
He sighed his disappointment, as if this conversation was little more than a waste of his time.
"Did you get your hands on him?" Did you kill him?
No, I didn't kill him. I never even saw him. He asked me to meet him at Enrique's, and he never showed.
And you never saw him last night?
No.
Are you sure? You just got done telling me you don't remember everything about last night.
No, I don't, I said. Suddenly it was hard to meet his eyes.
So you really can't be sure you didn't kill him, am I right?
There didn't seem to be a good answer to that question, so I kept quiet. Everhard shifted on his feet.
I understand you're an avid softball player, Mr. Kingston.
I used to be. I stopped playing a couple of years ago. I'd broken a finger.
It was only the pinky on my left hand.
Not too important as far as playing the bass guitar goes, but it had been a wake-up call that I was risking an injury that could severely mess up my music career, or what was left of it.
Still own the equipment? Your glove, ball, bat?
I nodded.
Mind if I have a look at that bat? He asked.
No, I'll get it.
May I come in?
I tried to picture my apartment. Was there anything incriminating up there? Of course there wasn't. Unless I killed Billy Reno and somehow don't remember doing it, I thought.
I'd rather you didn't, I said. I'll be right back.
I climbed up the stairs, holding tight to the railing. The weak feeling in my legs was now due to more than the alcohol in my system. I went to my bedroom closet where I remembered leaving the bat, but it wasn't there. My Mizuno infielder's mitt was there and a well-used-looking ball, but no bat.
Great. Had I lent it to someone?
I had no idea. I hadn't thought of that thing in 2 years.
I seem to have misplaced it, I told Detective Everhard when he got back down the stairs.
You seem to, he laughed. That's cute. I seem to have misplaced it.
You sure you didn't misplace it in Billy Reno's head?
I can look for it.
Why don't I come in and help you look?
No thanks, I said. I don't think it's here.
Where do you think it is?
I don't know. I really don't.
Well, you better hope you find it before I do, Mr. Kingston. Say, any idea why your business card was in Billy Reno's pocket?
He called me, said he needed help. He must have gotten my number from the card. I filled him in on the text I had received as well.
So, you told him to go to hell, and then he sent you a text message, and you changed your mind.
Yes. I'll need the number he called you from. And then what happened? I found the number Billy had called in my phone's history. Then we went through my story again. The witnesses he'd talked to claimed to know a lot more about what happened next than I did. Apparently I'd been asked to leave Enrique's. The owner of the nearest liquor store said I came in for a fifth of Southern Comfort and gave him an earful about Billy as well. After I'd repeated what little I knew 3 times, Everhard seemed ready to quit.
If I were you, I'd find that bat, Mr. Kingston.
I'll try.
You do that. I've got half a mind to arrest you right now. I'd say I have enough probable cause, but I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt since you used to be married to a member of the department.
He gave me his card.
Call me if you remember anything else, he said, making the quotation marks in the air with his other hand. Then he turned and walked down the wooden stairs and out toward his car. I stood, stunned, watching him drive away, and then I remembered I had a gig at 2 that day. Cursing, I ran back up the front stairs. I made another cup of coffee, changed my clothes. Opening the fridge, I saw a bottle of Southern Comfort, unopened. I was struck again by the eerie reality that I had done things I didn't remember, and then by the idea that I'd apparently thought booze needed refrigeration. What the hell was happening? Billy was dead? And I'd gotten so drunk I was blacked out? That wasn't like me. I loved drinking a beer or 3, but I hadn't gotten plastered enough to black out since college. I remembered being pissed off about Billy's call. I could imagine myself being even angrier when he didn't show up, but angry enough to drink myself into a stupor? I slapped together a Swiss cheese and mustard sandwich and choked it down. After my stomach churned a time or two and sent up an angry belch, the sandwich apparently decided to stay put.
Thankfully, the physical anguish I had awoken with was starting to fade, leaving only a grinding, gnawing fear. Somebody had killed Billy, and the police thought it was me. And could I be absolutely sure that they were wrong? Chapter 2. Sound FX Studios was in the Third Ward, a gentrified section of town just south of the business district, where rows of old warehouses had been converted into upscale clothing stores, coffee houses, and loft apartments. There was too much pedestrian traffic and not enough parking. I circled the block. The clock on my dash said I was 10 minutes late already. This wasn't some 2-bit demo for an American Idol wannabe from Fond du Lac. I was running late for a session with Mandy Silver. She was a country singer and songwriter with a string of #1 hits to her name from a few years back. She was a bit past her prime by Nashville standards, but she still managed to make it onto the charts from time to time because her songs were very good. The kind of songs that took you someplace you hadn't been to since the first time you fell in love. She had decided to make her next CD outside of Nashville, saying she needed a change of scenery and a bit of artistic freedom. The Nashville studios are basically a bunch of cookie cutters all turning out the same bland shit, she had told me over the phone when we'd booked the job. I had wanted to ask why she'd picked Milwaukee of all places and not Austin or even Chicago, but I didn't. This was one of the more high-profile gigs I'd had the chance to do in a while, and there was the possibility of a national tour if things went well. And here I was, 10 minutes late, looking for parking and wondering just how far I'd have to haul my fender and drag my behemoth of an amp on a day that was starting to turn unseasonably warm. After what seemed like my 10th trip around the block, a soccer mom in a Hummer bolted from a spot just in front of me and I eased my Civic in. I grabbed my gear and headed down the street, mentally composing my apology as I went. As it turned out, I didn't need to worry. I was the first one to arrive, and there was no sign of Mandy or her entourage. I didn't know if she'd have an entourage, but I assumed she would. People like her usually did. The reception area of Sound FX was Spartan, with a few Danish modern chairs painted black and upholstered in a garish zebra print. A woman with raven hair and multiple lip piercings sat chewing gum behind a black desk with an equally black Dell desktop computer that didn't appear to be powered up. She smiled at me through her gum, and I told her which session I was there for. She nodded and laughed nervously. "Where should I set up?" I asked her. She pointed to a door just past her desk. I wondered if she ever said anything. The studio door was painted black as well, and through a tinted window next to it I could make out a control room. Staring at all the black, I felt a giggly urge to buy a couple of cans of silly string and spray it everywhere. Before I had a chance to act on this urge, I heard the sound of footsteps climbing the stairs from the street. Mandy Silver pushed through the door, wearing a pale pink sweatsuit and white Nike tennis shoes. I had seen her picture in magazines and watched her on TV, but that didn't prepare me for the effect she had in person. She looked like a wax imitation of herself. Though she couldn't be much younger than me, based on what I knew of her, the skin on her face was taut. Straight blonde hair that was nearly white hung down just past her shoulders, contrasting with skin that was tanned a smooth brown. Her eyes were a royal blue that may or may not have been real. A low-cut T-shirt hinted at breasts that seemed firm despite their large size. The one hint of her true age came from her hands, which were too thin and bony to match the rest of her. "Hi," she said, with a smile that showed perfect white teeth. "I'm Mandy. You must be Paul." "That's me," I said. "Nice to meet you," she said, crossing the room to shake my hand. Her skin was cool and soft. Her entourage consisted of one man who came through behind her. He was sour-faced, with brown hair which had all but fled the top of his head. He wore a dark blue commando sweater and blue jeans. His trademark Nashville cowboy boots were walnut brown. "This is Tag Hewitt, my producer." The sour-faced man extended his hand. "Howdy," he said without smiling. "Thanks for coming to help us out." His handshake was too firm, as if he was trying to establish his dominance. I could see his shoulder tense with effort. "My pleasure," I said, relaxing my own hand in hopes that he'd let go of it. He did, his eyes boring into mine. Mandy bobbed her head toward the girl at the desk. "Hey, Trixie, you all ready for us?" Trixie grinned and nodded. I still hadn't heard her speak. "Tag, honey, give Mr. Kingston a hand with his gear, won't you?" Tag reached for the handle of my amp cart. My bass was still slung over my shoulder. We strolled together toward the control room door. "How's the record going so far?" I asked neither of them in particular. "Great," Mandy said. "We've got all the percussion done, and you're next. We had Horace Montgomery play drums. You know him?"
"Sure I do," I said, trying to hide my displeasure. Wendell Horace Montgomery had a garbled sense of timing and a bumper sticker that read, "I'd rather be riding." It was going to be a long day. It was even longer than I thought. I had learned Mandy's songs from some vocal and acoustic guitar demos she'd emailed to me. Her voice, the guitar player unknown, but I assumed it was her. Most songwriters know enough guitar chords to accompany themselves if they know how to write music at all. Bobby Schmidt, SoundFX's main engineer, gave me a queer look as he finished positioning the microphones near my amp and handed me a set of headphones. "It's a little rough," he said under his breath, before retreating to the safety of the control room. The shambles that Horace had made of some perfectly good demo tracks would have been funny if it had been someone else's problem. Late downbeats, misplaced accents, and a hi-hat on a shaky stand all assaulted my ears. At one point during the first song, I swear I heard him miss the bass pedal with his foot and hit it a beat and a half later. That was about as much as I could take. I stopped playing and waved my arms like a football referee signaling incomplete. "Hold on," I said. The demo track stopped. "What's wrong?" Tag's impatient voice in my headphones. "Look," I said, "I don't want to be a prima donna, but that drum track is useless." Tag raised a hand to wave me off, but I could see Bobby nodding vigorously and saying something that didn't come through my phones. I assumed it was some variation of, "See, I told you so." "Look, I know it's a little rough," Tag said, "but can you make it work?" I knew I should probably nod, make the best of it, collect my check, and leave. I'd just gotten started with one of the highest rent sessions I'd worked on in years, and here I was telling the producer his drum track sucked. Maybe it was the whole thing with Billy, but I just wasn't up for pretending that somebody else's shit smelled like a rose. "You got a click track on that demo?" I asked, hoping Mandy had recorded her demo to the beat of a metronome. This would mean her timing was good, even if Horace's wasn't. "Sure," Tag said. "Why?" "Great," I said. "We can play this one of two ways. Throw out the drums and let me record to the click. I'll find you a drummer who knows what he's doing later. Otherwise, you can keep the drums and find someone to replace me." I unstrapped my bass and took a step back toward the gig bag I'd draped over a music stand nearby, hoping to convince him I meant what I said. I saw Tag motion to Mandy, who was out in the lobby talking on her cell phone. She crowded into the control room and a conference ensued. Tag looked pissed. Having to do the drums over was going to cost time and money, and the boys at the label probably wouldn't like that. But Tag must have known Horace's work was lousy. He looked more and more resigned as Bobby kept working him. Mandy just listened, nodding slightly, until she bent to the control room mic and spoke into my headphones. "You really don't think we can use those drum tracks?" "You can use them if you want," I said, "but I can't."
The three of them spoke some more. Tag ran a tense hand through his sparse hair and then sat down.
"Okay, let's try it again," he said. "We'll mute the drums and give you a click."
After that, it went much better. Whoever had played guitar on the demo had good timing, and without Horace's drumming in my way, the bass parts rolled out like hot rods at a car show. We got through two songs before Tag held up his hands. "Let's take a break," he said. There was coffee in the lobby, across from Trixie's desk. I poured some into a styrofoam cup and paced, eager to stretch my legs. My headache had receded. The work had probably helped. Bobby passed me and headed for the door, probably on his way out for a cigarette. As I watched him go, I heard a voice behind me.
"Sounds great,"
I turned and saw Mandy standing behind me, smiling. Up close, her teeth gleamed like mirrors. Thanks. Thank you. She looked at the coffee maker, seemed to consider pouring some, then turned back to me. Figured. Wouldn't do for a woman like her to have coffee breath. You really helped us out in there. What do you mean? She sighed, and I tried not to watch her breasts heave up and down. Tag and I both knew that drummer was lousy, but we were trying to make the best of it. We're on a schedule here, you know? I know. Well, you're right. Those tracks are unusable, and we need to dump them before things get worse. She moved closer to me. It took balls to say what you did. Thanks. Don't mention it. She smiled, then turned and crossed the room to a sofa that sat nearer the entrance. I followed, wondering if she had actually paid someone to tailor a jogging suit. How else would it fit her so well? She eyed me as I sat down in a chair kitty-corner from her. You all right? She asked. I mean, I don't know you, but you look troubled. Is something wrong? Besides this bullshit with the drum track, I mean. Someone I know was murdered. I found out about it this morning. Oh, my God! Her eyes arched in surprise. I noticed how much mascara she was wearing. A friend of yours? Not really, I said, but I knew him a long time. Used to work with him. His name was Billy Reno. You've heard of him, I'm sure. He wrote Something in Your Eyes. The Rainy Mills song? She said, naming the country artist who'd recorded it after it had gone number one on the pop charts. Wow! He lived around here? Yeah. Wow, she said. She got up and went for that cup of coffee after all, pouring enough cream in it to change it beyond recognition. Do they know who did it? Don't think so. She nodded and looked away. I looked at the curves of her body. Sure, they were probably all smoke and mirrors, tricks of a surgeon's blade, but they sure looked like the real thing. Tag leaned out of the control room. Y'all ready to start again? Sure, I said, guessing that y'all could mean one person or several, depending on the circumstances. We'll be right there.
Thanks for listening to episode one of The Sweetest One, a Paul Kingston mystery by Stephen L. Moss. Music is by Jewelbeat. This has been a presentation of Northside Press, offered under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivative Works 3.0 license. For more information, please visit StephenLMoss.com.